Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Open Mic Session. Today's topic is Java version 5 and 6 performance tuning. My name is Joseph Lam, and today's session will give you the opportunity to speak to our panel of experts on a variety of subjects related to today's topic. Moving on to slide number 2. In today's Open Mic Session, we will start off by introducing to you our panel of experts for today. We will then move on to give you a brief introduction to Java version 5.6 performance tuning. Next, our panel of experts will answer questions that were pre-submitted to us via email. After that, we will open the lines for a live question and answer period. Finally, the session will end with a summary of the Open Mic session given by our panel of experts. Going on to slide number 3, at this time, I would like to introduce you to our panel of experts for today's call. Our panel consists of Gary Babu, Param Kusham from WebSphere Application Server L2 Support.
Hi, this is Gary.
Next, we have James Fox from WebSphere Application Server L2 Support.
Hello, this is James Fox.
Then we have Benay Hagaba from WebSphere Application Server SDK L2 Team.
Hi, this is Benay Bardo.
Next, we have Chris Bailey from the Java Service Strategy Team.
Hi, this is Chris Bailey.
Then we have Graham Rolson from Java Performance Team.
Hello, this is Graham Rolson.
Next, we have Daniel Julin from the STSM WebSphere Serviceability Team.
And hi, this is Dan Julin.
And finally, we have Ryan Champaconi from the J9 Garbage Collection Team.
Hi, everyone. This is Ryan Champaconi.
Thank you, Ryan. Moving on to slide number 4. Before we get to the question and answer period, we would like to give you a technical overview of the topic from Giri, one of our panel of experts for today. Please go ahead, Giri.
Thank you, Joseph. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Open Mic session on Java Performance Tuning. We'll start with a brief introduction to the various topics we're going to cover today. Next, we'll address some of the most frequently asked questions on Java performance before we open the phone lines for questions. As many of you might know, in Java 6, we introduced new concepts such as ahead-of-time compilation and compressed references for 64-bit JVMs. We'll explain how they work and the benefits in using them. Next, we'll talk about what is class sharing and how it helps in reducing the memory footprint of the Java process. We'll also discuss the differences between 32-bit and 64-bit, pros and cons of using 64-bit JVMs. Moving on to slide 5. We will go over the different GC policies that are available and how to choose the right one for your workload. Continuing on GC tuning, we'll discuss about heap sizing and how to address heap fragmentation. Lastly, we'll discuss some of the features of Java Health Center tools and the kind of problems you can debug using Java Health Center. Moving on to slide 6.
Thank you, Giri. We will now begin our question and answer session with questions that were pre-submitted to us ahead of time before the webcast. We are currently on slide number 6, and I will hand the presentation now over to our panel of experts.
This is Vinay, and I will be taking the question number 1. Question to me is, I would like to know more about the performance improvements in Java 6, especially AOT compilation, and compressed references for 64-bit JVMs. I will be taking the question for the AOT, and after me, Graham will be taking for the compressed references and 64-bit. Here, AOT, which means ahead of time, is a new compilation technique introduced in Java 6. The AOT compiler generates native code dynamically when an application runs and caches any generated AOT code in the shared data cache. All the subsequent JVMs that wish to execute the method can load and use the AOT code from the shared data cache. without incurring the compilation overhead, which is generally expected in JIT compilation native code. AOT data is generated for methods which is likely to be most effective. To go with more detail about it, you know about the just-in-time compiler, which compiles a Java bytecode to native code at runtime. It achieves better performance than static compilers for a number of benchmarks. However, the JIT compiler is a double-edged sword. Although JIT compilation can help improve performance of applications, the dynamic nature of JIT compilation increases the overhead during runtime and reduces the efficiency when fast response time is needed or when applications are starting up. Here, the AOT compiler acts as a good substitute that can achieve better startup performance and at the same time performs better than interpretation. The AOT compiler is enabled by default on WebSphere 7, but is only active when shared class is enabled. And you might be knowing in WebSphere 7, the shared classes are enabled by default. So when the AOT compiler is active, the compiler heuristically selects the method to be AOT compiled with the primary goal of improving the startup time. The dynamic compilation takes time to identify frequently executed methods as well as to compile those methods. Thus, the applications typically go through a warm-up period in which performance has not yet reached its peak. This warm-up period can be a performance issue for a number of reasons. The methods executing frequently during this warm-up phase might not contribute significantly to the application's steady-state performance. Performing JIT compilations that delay startup yet do not significantly improve the application's long-term performance are particularly wasteful. You can accelerate application startup by carefully using AOT compile code because this code, although typically slower than JIT compile code, can be many times faster than interpretation. Furthermore, because the time to load and bind AOT compile code is typically less than the time to detect and dynamically compile an important method, you can achieve performance earlier in a program's execution. Our experiments have shown that there is a significant startup improvement by using AOT compilation. In WebSphere application server, our experiments show that the improvement is up to 18%. And in rational application developer product, it's up to 10%. There are a couple of command line options you can use to fine-tune the AOT code in the cache. All those options are there in the Java 6 diagnostic guide. With this, I would conclude on my AOT part, and I will give it over to Graham to talk about compressed references.
Okay, thanks so much, Vinay. Just a quick overview, really, of what compressed reference support gives you in Java 6. So that the typical Java application running inside a JVM uses a large number of references to the areas of memory that it's using, so objects within the heap. For a 64-bit JVM, these references are to 64-bit memory locations, so each reference is 64-bit address, and it requires 64 bits, that's 8 bytes to hold it. But we know that the memory locations for 64-bit Java objects are 8-byte aligned, so that means that the lower 3 order bits in this address of a 64-bit Java object are zeros. So in compressed references, the function here exploits this redundancy so that we can effectively fit a 35-bit address reference into 32 bits of memory. So we can get a much larger address into the 4 bytes of memory that 32 bits will give us. So the effective maximum heap size becomes orders of magnitude larger. So, well, allowing for bits of other memory that we have to use, the effective maximum heap with compressed references on is about 28 meg. Well, we're compressing memory to do this, and this memory compression does come with a small overhead, but this extra cost is usually compensated by the benefits of using a lot less memory to contain the Java heap of the objects that you've created with these compressed references, as well as the fact that with 64-bit JVM on a 64-bit operating system, we get extra instructions quite commonly, and also that we get extra registers available with the 64-bit environment as well. So that gives us the chance to do further optimizations to benefit over the running of an equivalent 32-bit JVM. There's a white paper study that was made with WebSphere applications, mainly Daytrader 1.2, and they showed that the throughputs are between about 5% to 10% less using 64-bit compressed references than with a comparable 32-bit JVM. But bear in mind also that that was done with fairly small heaps, so that the heaps had to be less than 3 gigabytes to support a 32-bit JVM execution. And quite clearly with compressed references, if you wanted to use larger heaps, you're able to do that but still maintain those object sizes. The white paper actually shows that if you ran those same things with the 64-bit JVM without compressed references, it could cost you maybe up to as much as 20% in throughput, just because of the extra overhead of all of that extra memory accessing. So heap utilization, the garbage that's created per transaction for a compressed reference JVM, is actually quite similar to the amount that a 32-bit JVM creates. So you'd expect to see similar size objects in the heap for those running in compressed references. And again, comparing with a 64-bit uncompressed, typically you see something like 70% more space needed to contain all of these 64-bit locations, which can actually be reduced to 32-bit by the compressed reference mode of the Java 6 JVM. Well, that's all I was going to say in answer to question number one. If we could move on to question number two on slide seven.
Thank you, Graham. This is James. And question number two is, what consideration should be taken into account when choosing 32 versus 64-bit? Does 64-bit JVM have a bigger footprint when running the same application? And this is a good question, because we do see a lot of customers that are using a 64-bit JVM when it's not necessarily applicable or where there will not be any benefit, which does in turn cause a much larger footprint and a degradation in performance. It's an important decision when you're first designing or planning your install, because there really isn't an easy migration path from 32 to 64-bit. Actually, there is no official migration path other than reinstalling the WebSphere and redeploying the applications. But you do need to be able to plan for scalability and growth in the future. As we mentioned before, there are some benefits to 64-bit. You can have a much larger heap, which can be handy for if you have a lot of large file manipulation type jobs or large conversion type things, or jobs that will come in and don't necessarily require a fast turnaround but do require a large footprint in memory. You also can have a larger static caches, so if you have a static cache, that may be more beneficial to keep it in a large heap as opposed to going out to a database. But if these cache entries are frequently invalidated, then you'll probably lose a lot of the benefit of having the larger heap. There's also another benefit is that there's good performance improvements with 64-bit architecture on computationally intensive applications. One area that we see a lot of benefit would be if you have an application that's very heavy in WebSphere, web services security. And as Graham had mentioned, for 64-bit on the IBM platforms for version 7, we do have the compressed references, which helps to recover a lot of the performance, the overhead size and performance that you lose going to 64-bit, and still allows you to go up to quite a large heap size. You know, but unfortunately, the larger the heap, the more expensive it is to maintain, and the slower things get. So once again, the cons of this are going to be that with a 64-bit JDK, you are going to have a significantly higher overhead and footprint, as Graham had mentioned, and your overall performance is going to be decreased. So in a lot of cases, unless you have a specific need to use 64-bit, it's better to scale horizontally to several smaller heaps as opposed to one large heap under 64-bit. And with that, I'll move on to question number three.
So this is Graham Rawson here again. Question number three, what kind of performance improvements are delivered by class sharing in both Java 5 and Java 6? I think we've already outlined here that there are two major areas of improvement to be expected from class sharing. So that's that there should be a decreased startup time, and you reduce the total memory usage when you're considering sharing amongst multiple JVMs. So class sharing is a means of caching class files, and in Java 6 that includes AOT compiled code as well. You can share that between multiple JVMs. or a single JVM can populate the cache, and then when it's restarted, it can reuse the contents of that cache. This cache is a memory map file in Java 6, so its contents are persistent across a system restart. And in Java 5, the cache was actually in shared memory, so if you rebooted the server that you were running on, then you actually lost that cache and it would have to be rebuilt. Now, how does it improve startup times? It provides very fast class loading time from this cache rather than having to go out to read the class files from disk. This is a benefit to a JVM when it's restarted, or if you're using multiple JVMs. So if you start additional JVMs that can also use that same class cache, either populated by its previous execution or by another JVM that's still running. And using compile AOT code also gives you reduced startup times, as we already heard, since the methods are available in a pre-compiled form that in most cases execute faster than having to execute them in interpreted code. AOT code is also subject to JIT compilation too, so an AOT loaded method can become even further optimized if the Java methods are frequently invoked. The memory footprint benefits can only really be realized if you're running multiple JVMs that are sharing the same cache. But since running a multiple JVM on a server is pretty common practice, it's this sort of configuration that will gain most from the reduced memory usage when using class sharing. And there's a DeveloperWorks article called Enhanced Performance with Class Sharing listed in the reference material that comes with this session. And I co-wrote that, and in that article we set out to demonstrate the benefits of shared classes. In that case, we actually used the Eclipse IDE and the Apache Tomcat server, mainly so that anybody could pick this document up and download those software products and play with them themselves, just in a fairly simple sandbox way. So even with that simple sandbox configuration that we used in this article, we saw that just under a second was actually shaved off the startup time of an Eclipse IDE having first populated the shared class cache, reducing startup from about 4.2 seconds to 3.3 seconds. And that shared class cache actually contains something like 4 megabytes of class data. So in this particular case, I don't think it's likely people would use multiple Eclipse IDEs, but should they do so, then they would actually save about 4 megabytes of class data as well. With the Tomcat servo in a simple startup, that went up to about 6 megabytes. And we still saw that same kind of improvement in startup as well, in the order of like 25%. So is shared class functions turned on by default? That's also one of the parts of this question. And so I think we've already heard that in WebSphere 7, the answer to that question is yes. But I would actually just outline here that taking the JVM itself, using the properties that WebSphere uses, but the actual default behavior of the IBM JVM is not to use shared classes. It just so happens that the WebSphere configuration actually turns that stuff on and sets up a shared class cache for you as well. And is it possible to customize it? Well, yes, it is, of course. You can specify the size of the shared class cache that you want. You can specify how much of that shared class cache you want to hold AOT code by setting minimum and maximum values. And also, if you want to, you can set up multiple caches so that different JVMs can share different caches between them, and you name those in parts of the startup parameters. You can fine-tune what classes are to be loaded into the shared class cache and which methods are to be eligible for AOT compilation as well. So to restrict the classes that are eligible for sharing, you can write a shared class filter. And I think it's already been explained, you can use an AOT limit file to restrict the methods that are going to be eligible for AOT compilation. And if you want to do this kind of stuff, then it's all described in quite some detail in the Java Diagnostics Guide. Right, so that was me finished on that question. If you could move over to the question on slide number 9.
Thanks, Graham. This is Ryan Champicone. Question 4. I hear there are now more options in terms of GC policies in Java 5 and Java 6 compared to its predecessors. How do I choose the right one for my application or environment? What are some of the basic tuning recommendations based on my application characteristics, load, throughput, etc.? So that's a great question, because we actually have some new technology in place introduced in Java 5. However, there are also some subtle changes made to the existing GC policies that are carried over into Java 5, and I'd like to cover those as well. So as a bit of remedial or reminder, the two major ones, or two major GC policies available, are op throughput, which is targeted for the best throughput for workloads and is also the default, as well as opt average pause, which is targeted for best average response time or best average GC pause time. So opt throughput consists of a single GC pause or what's otherwise known as the stop the world event. And that single GC pause includes all typical phases of garbage collection. That includes all live object tracing, sweeping of dead objects onto the free list, as well as an optional compact phase to reduce fragmentation. Opt-average pause is very similar in terms of its functionality to opt-throughput. However, it interleaves the tracing or marking phase with the Java application, such that threads are taxed based on their allocation to perform GC work. This is all while other Java application threads continue to execute. The sweep and the optional compact phase do remain part of the stop the world phase. Now, there is also, as some will note, a third GC policy that is also carried over, known as subpools. This is typically an architecture-specific GC policy available only on Power and now Z architecture, starting in Java 5, and is targeted for systems that are large core systems or otherwise known as large processing unit systems. Typically, we do not recommend this GC policy unless there are at least 16 cores or greater on the system. So two of the major subtle changes to these existing GC policies are that starting with Java 5, the optional compaction phase is now parallelized. Now what this means is that if there are additional processing units or cores in your system, i.e. greater than one, the compactor will make use of all of those processing units in order to perform its compaction. This is in contrast to compaction being a single-threaded operation in the past. So compaction times will be reduced and performance improved. Starting in Java 6, opt-average pause has been improved to further reduce GC pause times by also making the sweep phase concurrent as well. The compact phase still remains in stop the world, but the removal of the sweep phase or moving it into the concurrent side along with tracing further reduces the average GC response time. Now, there is in fact a new GC policy known as GenCon, and this is targeted at workloads that frequently create and abandon objects, and this is commonly referred to as the generational leak hypothesis, which is objects die young. And this hypothesis has been around for going on 25 plus years now. The way this works is that the heap is now divided into what amounts to two separate regions, a new and an old region, or a nursery and a tenure region. Your application ends up allocating all of its objects, or the majority of its objects, out of the nursery. Once the nursery is full, what's known as a local collection, sometimes nicknamed the scavenger, will occur. And this only collects objects in the nursery area. Once that collection is completed, allocation resumes, and Java execution resumes. Objects remain in the nursery until they've survived a sufficient number of nursery collections. So over time, an object that is allocated there will remain in the nursery until a certain number of collects have occurred. At that point, we deem that the object is going to be long-lived and is moved to the tenure area. This action is typically known as tenuring. When the tenure space is finally full or is approaching fullness, a global collection occurs. Now, there's some interesting technical aspects to this new policy. One is that it's an implicitly compacting collector. So, in essence, this is constantly removing and eliminating fragmentation. This, at the same time, ends up reducing contention on memory and, therefore, the allocation lock, which can improve performance. As well, this ends up improving locality of objects, which can actually improve the performance of your system. At the same time, this can actually lower your pause times because it's actually focusing on a smaller part of the heap. However, the important note here, and this goes back to the workload that it's targeted at, it is dependent on a low survival rate of objects. So the expectation is that this would be a workload whose objects, when they're allocated, a large percentage of them die very quickly after they've been allocated. Surprisingly, there are many Java workloads, including the application server, that fall under this pattern. The other thing to note is that this is not real-time. There are absolutely no pause time guarantees here in this policy or any of the other policies. In addition, the global collection that occurs when the tenure space is full is based in part on the opt-average pause technology. So it is concurrent, taxation-based, and helps reduce pause times. I should note for all of the policies that all operations and all phases within the garbage collection are parallelized. And this is to say that in a stop the world pause, work is performed by multiple GC threads. And the number of GC threads by default matches the number of processing units, cores, hardware threads, CPUs that exist in your system. So, with all that information, what policy do you choose? I actually think that the better question in some cases that leads into the answer to that is, why are there so many policies and why not just one? And the simple answer to that is that there are different problem areas and different expectations on results. Are you looking for raw throughput and your evenness or length of pause times are unimportant? Or are you very concerned with pause times and are willing to endure small yet frequent pause times at the expense of a reduction in performance? So the garbage collector is actually unable to tell what the end user or application developer's expectations really are. And this is why that we require that some level of input or guidance, this being the GC policy command line option, is required from our end. So that having been said, really, you know, which policy should I be using? Our recommendation generally, out of the box, is to actually go with GenCon, the new GC policy. This tends to be our strongest overall performer and tends to get our best results even in application server environments. Most workloads tend to follow the weak generational hypothesis. It does target low pause times, often lower pause times than what are available in opt-average pause, but I should note that there are more frequent pause times. Okay, so this results in many smaller interruptions. This can also reduce the frequency of compaction, in part because it's an implicitly compacting collector, and in part because it's constantly sifting through all of the garbage, getting rid of it, and keeping only the long-lived objects and moving them to the tenure area. So this is very, very important. The drawback, however, is that it isn't for all workloads. Okay? It is targeted specifically for workloads where objects do die young. If the objects do not die young, your performance will be significantly compromised. So, if you do have a workload that maybe doesn't have objects that die young, there are the alternatives, which are the traditional models. Off-throughput, this is where pause times tend not to be an issue, and you're looking for infrequent garbage collects. This is actually a very good policy to use if you have an agent-style virtual machine. So if you're looking to bring up a virtual machine quickly, run a very small transaction, and then complete, and the expectation is that you're not going to use very much memory and possibly not garbage collect at all, off-throughput is probably the way to go. Similarly, opt-average pause is infrequent pause times and also targets a low pause time value. That having been said, it does require a bit more room on your heap, and it does have an execution overhead, and this will impact your performance relative to opt-throughput. So that concludes question 4. I'd like to move on to question 5 on slide 10. And this is Ryan again answering both. So question 5. Part A, is heap fragmentation still an issue in Java 5 and 6? If so, how should I address that? I would like to know the pros and cons using fixed heap size versus variable heaps. And part B, do you have any tips and tricks in tuning the application server in relation to the JVM perm setting and the proper K-cluster setting? I certainly have the answers, and I certainly have tips and tricks. So the simple answer to part A is that no, fragmentation is not the issue that it was in previous versions of Java. So the biggest culprits for fragmentation were both pinned objects and pinned data pens or data areas within the heap itself. And really, problems with fragmentation would result in low performance or even the inability to allocate a sufficiently large object, even though the total free memory was available. It was impossible for all free memory to be coalesced into one chunk for allocation. The key point, starting with Java 5, is that these pinned objects and pinned data pens are now a thing of the past. The garbage collector can now accurately determine object references on the stack, and in fact, all object references into the heap are now accurately identified. What this means is that we can now take any object on the heap and move it around anywhere that we want, unbeknownst to the application developer, relocate the reference, and everything works fine. Okay? JNI traditional API for getting array contents does not pin objects, However, the critical class of APIs do pin objects by preventing the GC. And finally, this partially answers question B, is that P and K clusters no longer exist. Okay? The equivalents are either moved off the heap or have become first-class citizens within the heap themselves. And what this means is that these elements are now completely mobile within the heap and are eligible for compaction just like any other object. So that addresses some of the shortcomings of the previous versions of Java. However, there is still potentially a form of natural fragmentation that can occur just through program execution, allocation of objects, the death of objects. This does result in a natural form of fragmentation that occurs over time. Well, this has also been addressed. As noted in question 4, compaction in the global collector is now parallelized. This is in contrast to previous versions of Java where it was single-threaded. This makes full use of the processing units available, therefore reducing the pause times and improving performance. Similarly, in the Gen Con garbage collector policy, the nursery collector is an implicitly compacting garbage collector, naturally reducing fragmentation. It's important to note that prior to this, due to pinned objects and pinned data areas, it was virtually impossible to have any of this technology be introduced due to pinning. So, part B, you know, what tips and tricks are there available for improving performance? Really, to start with, it's important to note that tuning is really an iterative process. My recommendations typically are to keep things simple, keep things very, very static, change one thing at a time, measure the result, rinse and repeat. Also, it's important to measure underload. I understand that it's not always possible to measure underload, but if you can, please do so. If it's not due to any number of reasons, including the fact that it may be that there's only one resource available to run under load and it's just impossible to scale to that level of experimental deployment, do the math on reducing the working set to an appropriate smaller deployment size and measure at that point. But it's very key to measure what you're trying to deploy. So there are some options to actually consider when tuning. The obvious ones are the maximum heap and the starting heap size. I personally recommend starting with these equal, i.e. do not allow expansion or contraction. This reduces the number of variables in the heap. You can observe the complete working set of your workload over time and then size down both MX and MS appropriately to the levels that you need. This allows you to account for things like engineering capacity and so on that you may need. Other options that are very important to consider are things such as GC threads. Now with virtualization, it's not always true that the number of processing units, again, cores or hardware threads, reported back to the VM match those that are actually physically available, particularly in overcommitted environments. So it may be that you have to reduce the number of GC threads in order to improve performance. Putting GC threads counts above the available processing unit resource is a performance loss in this case. There are also other options, large pages, for example, enabling that is very important, -XLP, -X compressed rest, as noted in previous questions, a very important option to look at when using 64-bit to help reduce contention in the memory wall case. And finally, the nursery size, -XMN, when using the Gen Con policy. This defaults to 1/4 of the heap. However, depending on workloads, you may actually want to look at increasing or decreasing this. Now, finally, and this will be addressed in later questions and is in some sense a good segue, tools are available. Please look at the available tooling. These will help guide you in the process and are further elaborated in later questions. So that concludes question number 5. I'd like to move on to question number 6 on slide 11.
Hi, this is Chris Bailey. So question 6, part A, what is the Java Health Center? Is it a part of Java 5 or 6, or should I download it separately? What are the benefits of Health Center over other tools such as Tivoli Performance Viewer, ITCAM, or Wiley? Are there any performance overhead, and can I use it in production? So to answer the first part of that question, what is Java Health Center? So the Java Health Center is some new tooling that's only just been released. It's actually available in tech preview at the moment, and you obtain it through the IBM Support Assistant. So like most monitoring tools, there is a small agent that plugs into your running Java process, so a small modification to the WebSphere command line activates it, And then you have a client-based GUI, which you can run on Linux or Windows, and you can monitor what's going on inside that Java process. So what does it give you in the way of live monitoring? So it gives you information about the classes being loaded as they're loaded and gives you a timeline for them. It gives you the environment that your system's running in. But most importantly, it gives you live, low-overhead monitoring of garbage collection, of locking, and of method profiling. And it uses this information to give you a health status of your running application. So it lets you know whether it sees any problems in the application as it's running, and then starts to give you recommendations based on the data flow that it's seeing from your application. So as you've heard from Ryan previously, there are several different GC policies, and there are various different ways in which you can size your Java heap. So two of the things that Health Center will do for you is if it believes that you're running with the wrong GC policy, it will actually recommend which policy to use. Likewise, if it believes your Java heap is missized, it will provide you a recommendation on how to resize your Java heap. In terms of the locking and the profiling, it actually flags up locks, so synchronized blocks of Java code, where it sees they're being highly contended, so you've got performance bottlenecks in your application. And in terms of the profiling, it's a low-overhead method profiler that will tell you whether you've got any code paths which are being hit particularly hard and whether you're looping in sections of code and so on. So what are the benefits of Health Center over some of the other performance tools? Well, the first one is that one of the main goals of Health Center was to be very low overhead to such an extent that it is possible to use it in production. Now, one of the advantages of being tied closely to the IBM JVM is that the overhead that it has is much smaller than the alternative tools. So it plugs directly into some data that's already being generated inside the VM and is exporting that to visualize things for you. So one of its big advantages is that it has low overhead. The other side of the coin, where it doesn't do as good a job as the likes of the Tivoli tools or Wiley, is that those tools specifically are there to manage J2EE applications and to J2EE deployments. So they have some additional functions in there that look at your EJB performance and your web container and so on. And that isn't inside Health Center. Health Center is a little bit more basic and generic than that, but it is the lowest overhead profiling that is potentially available because it plugs directly into the JVM and gives you live monitoring and gives you live recommendations on errors it sees inside the running application and gives you recommendations on how to fix those. So that's the quick overview of what is in Java Health Center. As I said, it's available from the IBM Support Assistant and is out now available for use. And I'll now hand over to Dan Julin to talk about Part B of Question 6.
Okay, thank you, Chris. So Part B is how do I use the IBM tools to understand a code and file or thread them, thread and monitor them, analyze, doesn't pinpoint where the issue within the code is. So it's a pretty broad question. I'll try to answer quickly to leave time for open questions. Maybe we can just have, you know, follow-up questions for more details later if someone's interested. So let's see. At a high level, there are three basic kinds of dumps you can get from a JVM. You can get a thread dump, you can get a core dump that we also call a system dump, and you can get a heap dump. To deal with a thread dump, but that's actually a text file, so you know you could just look at it, you know, in an editor, but it's often more convenient to use a tool. The tool that we recommend at this time to analyze thread dumps is the Thread and Monitor Dump Analyzer that's available in IBM Support Assistant. You'll see a lot of things in that tool from the thread dump. The main things you would probably look at, particularly when you're looking at, you know, performance issues, is, you know, you will see the stack traces from all the threads and the state of all the monitors that may, you know, that may be held at various times in the JVM. So that's the thread and monitor dump analyzer. To deal with a core dump or a system dump, the main tool that we propose is the dump analyzer. It's also available in IBM Support Assistant. That tool actually does a lot of different things. There's a lot of different modules. The main module you would probably start with, again, you know, particularly for performance problems, would be the default dump report module, and it would give you similar information to what you would see in a thread dump. It would give, you know, show you the stacks of all the threads, show you the states of monitors, a few other things. That's the basic information. You can, however, with Dump Analyze, get a lot more information that you could not get from a thread dump with other modules. So there's other modules that could help you get a glimpse of the use of native memory in your JVM, for instance. Or one thing that may be particularly interesting here is you can use some modules to view the contents of some data structure. So one example is suppose you're looking at a thread dump or a stack trace in Dump Analyzer, and you see that some thread is busy doing a lot of work doing some sort of XML operation. Well, the stack trace will show you the methods that are being used, so you'll notice some XML work going on that's, you know, maybe using a lot of CPU, taking performance, but you wouldn't know from the stack trace alone what the name of the file that's being produced or written or read or what the contents of that file is, because that's not method names, that's the data that's actually in the JVM. Dump Analyzer would let you examine those data structures and find, you know, that information about one, what exactly is that thread doing. Similarly, if you have a thread that seems to be busy doing a database access and taking a long time to return, the thread dump would show you, well, it is a database access based on the methods, but which SQL query is being sent into which database. That's not shown in the stack trace, but you could see that by examining the data structures using Dump Analyzer. Let's see, and then, you know, just briefly on heap dumps, you know, as mentioned, you know, in several of the previous questions, a lot of performance issues actually, you know, are related to memory utilization issues in the JVM, so, you know, examination of heap dumps is also important. Two, there's a lot of tools for dealing with heap dumps. The two main ones that we would propose today are the memory dump diagnostic for Java, also known as MDD4J, and the Eclipse Memory Analyzer, also known as MAT or MAT. So the difference between the two, MDD4J is currently in late beta, soon to be re-released in IBM supported systems. It's giving you a high-level view of the contents of your memory without too much interactions, basically a number of predefined reports, and if you find what you need, what you're looking for in one of these predefined reports, that's great. If you don't, well, you know, that's it for that tool. If you want to get into more details and manually drill down into anything in your memory, the main tool we would suggest is the Memory Analyzer tool that lets you, you know, manually go and look at anything you would like to see in your memory. So that's a brief overview of the tools. Just quickly on the last part of the questions, you know, about pinpointing where the issue is in the code. Basically, most of the tools don't have access or don't look at the source code of the application or the program that's running the JVM, so they're not going to get to the level of finding, you know, where in that source code the problem is. What you would do with those tools is use them to find the general area where the problem is. More typically, you know, figure out which class, you know, is executing or which class seems to be having a problem, which method is supposed to be, you know, it looks to be having a problem or which class seems to be leaking. And then knowing the class or the method, you would go look yourself in your source code and try to figure out, you know, what is it doing and, you know, why is it behaving the way it is and the way that we don't want. So most of the tools, you know, would work the same way in this case. You know, in thread monitor, Dump Analyzer, for instance, you would find stack traces, you would find threads that seem to be particularly active, running frequently, using a lot of CPU, or you would look for threads that have stack traces that seem to be frequently waiting for something, waiting for a database, or waiting in contention to access locks and monitors in the JVM, and you would look at those stack traces, look at the methods on those stack traces, and figure out from there where in the application code the problem is likely to lie. And I guess I'll stop here and maybe let it to open questions to see if we want to get into more details. So, Joseph, I guess it's your turn.
Thank you again to our panel of experts for answering the pre-submitted questions. At this point, Vicky, we would like to open the line for questions.
Our first question will come from Sanjeev Joshi with Verizon Wireless.
Right. My question is, in the previous JVMs, like JVM4, what we have seen is that the virtual set size expands, and unless we restart the Java process, there is no way for the OS to reclaim the memory space that has been consumed by the JVM. Is that behavior any different going forward in Java 5 and 6?
Hey, this is James Fox, and I think what you're—and correct me if I'm wrong—but what you're describing is where the if you're monitoring the native memory usage of a process on the OS, it'll constantly grow, but
yep.
It never goes down and shrinks back. And I think that's more of a—I think it should be the same. You know, not depending it doesn't matter what OS, what Java version it is. I think that's more of a matter of how the OS reports its memory usage and how it reserves it and then reclaims it. And it shouldn't be an issue until you run into a problem where, of course, it exceeds the bounds of a, you know, what a 32-bit process should take. But I think that's more of an OS type, the way the OS represents the memory, not necessarily what the actual memory, native memory in use is being used, but more being reserved. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. I'm just saying, like, okay, the OS continues to report what has been consumed.
Right.
Even if the JVM marks it free for allocation, the OS never reports it as free.
What OS specifically? Because I know it's different.
We are in Linux, Red Hat.
On Linux?
Yeah. Enterprise 4.
Yeah, and I believe that it's, you know, it isn't necessarily using it, but it has reserved it, and once it reserved it, it doesn't, you know, allow it to disclaim, correct?
Right.
Right, and I believe that's, and anybody else can jump in and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think that is the expected behavior, and that's how it behaves on all versions of the JVM for Linux specifically, but the different OSs report it in different ways.
Okay, thanks for your input.
Our next question will come from Herman Huber with IBM.
Hello, first of all, thanks for answering most of the questions I had actually in this area. But still there are some questions left. First of all, it would be important, informative for me. Is there any sort of performance report available comparing different Java options, different JDK versions, garbage collections, settings, etc.? And especially interesting for me would be to have compared the 32-bit JVM versus a 64-bit JVM with compressed references.
Hi, it's Graham Lawson here. I was thinking, actually, this is a web server orientated question, really, isn't it? And so there is a white paper that's been issued comparing the performance, or a little bit of the performance anyway, with the compressed references with WebSphere 7, well, with and without compressed references and 32-bit. In terms of comparing Java 5 and Java 6, we publish stuff on the industry standard benchmarks like Spectre App Server and Spectre JVB, but the difficulty there is that in terms of a comparison, nearly always the hardware has moved on by the time we actually get them to create another version. So I don't actually have in my back pocket a table of, or a publicly available table anyway of the same environment running the same JVM. But as I said, there's white paper in terms of 64-bit stuff available on the WebSphere.
For future reference, if you go to Google or a search engine and you search for WebSphere V7 performance 64-bit, it will usually be one of the top ones up there.
But there's no performance report available comparing same JVM with different settings, etc. Because that's actually customers are always asking the first, if you start a new discussion, the first question is how much overhead you have when you enable GC or when you use Help Center, or the other question is how much overhead is the 64-bit and etc.
Right. Yeah, and I think this paper will only address the 64-bit. I do not know of a performance report that implements the different, you know, that granular as far as what the Help Center cost would be or anything like that. But
well, I can talk about the studies that we've done in-house, and we haven't, I mean, it's not yet publicly available, but the expectation was that the health center would cost no more than about a 3% hit on throughput running a highly utilized server. That was the design point, and we actually measured this with Daytrader, the WebSphere benchmark Daytrader, to make sure that it came in on target. So that's what the aim was, and that's what it achieved on Windows 64-bit anyway. That's in Java 6.
One last question regarding compressed references. What is the downside of using compressed references? We accept that the max heap is limited to somewhere around 28 gigabytes. Are there any other downsides?
Well, the instructions are still a bit larger, so it's possible that you could get a slight overhead from things like the instruction cache misses being greater than 32-bit. Because, well, as I say, you're still working in a 64-bit instruction set. It's just the references to the heap which are smaller so that you can reduce the impact that way. So I think that's possibly the major downside.
Yeah, I think if and of course this does vary wildly, you know, depending on application and architecture, and the link I put in there does try to quantify it with some numbers, whereas and I hate to quote the numbers because it's not going to necessarily fit the same for everybody's environment, but the using, you know, the trade app or the trade benchmarks, they were basically seeing that there was anywhere from 80 to 85% throughput when you use 64-bit, and then when you go to the compressed references, you could get up to 95% of the throughput of a 32-bit environment. So, I mean, there is a little bit of a cost, but it's definitely much better than just flat straight.
And I think, James, you gave the words of wisdom already, didn't you, that if you can fit into a 32-bit address range, then use a 32-bit JVM.
Right.
64-bit compressed references is really good for if you want to exploit larger heaps and need a 64-bit JVM to do it.
Right. And, I mean, it's really a question also of do you really want to have a larger heap, being that just a larger heap, 32-bit or 64-bit or 64-bit compressed, the larger the heap, the more expensive and harder it is to maintain. And oftentimes you'll find that your performance would be better to scale to multiple smaller JVMs as opposed to trying to stick everything into one larger JVM. So there is overhead to compressed refs, but there's also the inherent overheads to maintaining a larger heap size as well.
But if customers are developers think 32-bit heaps are too small for them, the option we should go for is 64-bit with compressed references.
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. In fact, with WebSphere 7.0 at 7.0.0.3, it becomes a default option. It's turned on by default.
If you install the 64-bit version.
Yeah, only on the 64-bit version, and only if the heap size is less than, I think, 25 gig.
Okay.
So if it's 64-bit and the heap size is lower than, I believe, 25 gig, there's an APAR out there that describes it in more detail, then compressed references will automatically be enabled on 7.0.0.3.
That's cool. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we'll hear from Jen Lorenzall with ING.
Yes, if you're using the Gen Con policy on a Power 5 server and you have multiple application server instances on a box, what's the best way to determine the number of GC threads appropriate for each JVM?
Hi, this is Ryan. So my recommendation is really going to depend on the level of load that each of the instances is going to experience. By default, the number of GC threads goes to the number of processing units available. So if you sort of think about that logically, that means that every VM is going to get the same number of threads, and there's a high potential for competition of resources across them. If there's not a lot of load going across the instances, that's actually not an unreasonable approach to take. You're going to get lower pause times and there tends to be lower conflicts. However, as the load increases on each of the instances and the frequency of garbage collection increases, I would actually start to really pare things down. So take the number of processing units that you have and really divide by the number of instances, and that's really sort of the baseline number that I would start with. That really avoids competition between GC threads between VM instances, as well as GC threads and application threads from different instances as well. So that's really my starting recommendation and going from there. And again, it's really going to depend highly on the level of load that you're experiencing on, and what really, you know, from an engineering capacity point of view, what you're really expected to handle in the worst case.
And on a Power 5, is that the number of physical CPUs or logical CPUs?
So I would that's a great question. And this goes back to sort of the partitioning one statement that I made. I'm going to pass this on to James, but my recommendation is that you're going to want to look at the number of logical ones. But really, I'll pass it on to James and let him kind of give a deeper answer.
And that's a good question, because we have seen the number of threads it does by default is based off the logical. And we have seen customers that may have a 32, you know, logical cores, and they're running, you know, 20-something app servers. And without adjusting those GC threads, each one of those app servers then has, I guess, 31 GC helper threads, which then you get into kind of – you pass the point of diminishing return, and you get into an issue more of context switching. So it really depends. There's, you know, that point of diminishing return is generally pretty high up there as far as hardware and number of JVMs that you're running. But, of course, you do tend to see that if you have, you know, a system with a high number of cores, then customers are generally going to want to run with that number. So, you know, I think, as Ryan had said, you really have to kind of look at it on a per-usage basis and then partition the number of GC threads based on throughput for those specific JVMs, just making sure that you take into consideration that you don't want to pare it down too low just to help prevent the pause times, but you also want to make sure that you're slicing up the pie, you know, evenly across all the JVMs.
Okay. Yeah, one thing we were seeing was a lot of CPU starvation.
Yeah, and that you probably got a lot of that because CPU starvation messages are fairly misleading. They're generally caused by the long GC pauses. So was your CPU actually, you know, were you in a deficit for that, or did the CPU look fine at the time?
We were seeing CPU getting pretty high.
So yeah, so I mean that could be either, but definitely if you have a lot of JVMs and a lot of cores, you probably would benefit to pare down to if you have the luxury, be iterative and do it slowly. If you've got 32 CPUs or cores, then pare it down to 24, GC helper threads, and then see what your results are, and then pare it down to 16, and keep going until you find the sweet spot for what your application needs.
Okay, thanks.
Just a reminder to press star 1 if you do have a question. Next, we'll hear from Alan Issa with IBM.
Oh, yes. Given that the Health Center tool is in tech preview, is it really ready yet for production use?
So that's a good question. And it's the same as deploying anything new into an existing application. So you should treat it as if you're doing an application update, which means put it into your test environment and put it through load before you deploy anything. What I can tell you is, like most monitoring tools, as it's in two parts, you have a small agent that plugs into your application itself, and you have the client. The majority of the work is in the client side. The agent is very small and light and has been heavily stress tested. So that's the only point that can actually damage your application itself. And that is very stable. It's been through multiple months' worth of testing in the lab. So, yes, it should be worthy to put into production, but as usual, you should try it in test first, especially as with anything performance monitoring based, you don't really know what the overhead's going to be on your application until you try it. So whilst, as Graham Rawson mentioned earlier, its design point was to have less than a 3% overhead on a heavily utilized system, and that's the way it performs in the lab against standard benchmarks and some WebSphere test cases, you never know how it's going to work on a live deployment until you try it. So, yes, it should be good to work in production, but as ever, put it into a test system, run a lot of loads through it, check the performance characteristics, and treat it as any other bit of third-party software that you were installing into your deployment.
Okay, thanks.
Next, we'll hear from AT&T's Ashwin Tadapalli.
And was just answered by James that to explicitly take advantage of compressed reference for VAST7 64-bit, you don't have to specify any JVM command line switch. So yeah, I'm assuming that is a positive answer. Like by default, if your heap size is less than 24-25 gig, it's enabled by default.
Correct. And I found the APAR for that is PK75174. And that's to auto-enable compressed references on the description of it is for, it says PowerPoint or PPC, AIX PPC 64, but it went into Windows or Linux as well. And that's if the heap size is less than 25 gigabytes. One interesting point about that is that since that has been enabled, it just to save you time if you're looking for it, even if you have the minus X compressed refs, since WebSphere adds that, you can't necessarily remove it. So to disable that, you would put in the minus X no compressed refs as a generic JVM argument if you did have a need to, you know, remove that or not use compressed references.
What was the APAR number again? Can you repeat it?
I sure can. Let me bring it up real quick. It was PK75174.
Okay.
That went in on 7003 of WebSphere.
Okay. My other question relates to how does any of the IBM existing GC policy contrast to the latest Sun GC, G1 policy. So is there any existing document out there on the IBM site? I believe there were like a previous webcast compiling all of the GC policy information from the Sun platform, but I have not seen anything with related to how does it contrast with the G1 policy. So
this is Ryan. The short answer to that is no, we don't have a document that actually outlines this. I will note, however, though, that the G1 policy is still not actually supported. I do realize it's available for beta purposes or experimental purposes right now in the latest service refresh. However, it's not due to go out in production until Java 7. So at this point in time, it's very difficult for us to actually evaluate or compare and contrast relative to our own GC policies. I can actually say, you know, at a higher level, that it certainly is approaching the grounds of real-time or soft real-time in the sense of attempting to achieve low, consistent, rhythmic or metronomic style pause times. And in that particular case, I would redirect you, if you're looking for these low rhythmic pause times that are highly predictable on a standard Java system, to take a look at our WebSphere real-time for Linux product, which is actually a JVM that will run with a low, so sub 10 millisecond pause time garbage collector.
Okay, thank you.
And at this time, there are no further questions. Mr. Lamb, I'll turn things back over to you for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you, Vicki. At this moment, I would like to pass the presentation over to Giri for a summary of today's session.
Hello, this is Giri here again. Just a quick recap on what we discussed today. We talked about new features in Java 6, such as AOT compilation and motivation for introducing compressed references for 64-bit JVMs. We also talked about the differences between 32-bit and 64-bit and how to decide if 64-bit is for you. Also talked about the performance improvements delivered by class sharing, such as faster startup times and smaller footprints. We also discussed the various GC policies and how to select the right one for your application. Talked about tuning strategies on heap sizing and fragmentation. And lastly, we talked about tools such as Java Health Center, Dump Analyzer, and MDD4J to troubleshoot various performance issues. That concludes the session for today. And at this time, I would like to hand it over to Joseph.
Thanks again, Giri, for a great summary. At this time, we will conclude the Open Mic session.